Helen and I started attending the Catholic Church in Red Lake. It was a dusty little adobe mission, and I didn't particularly cotton to the priest, Father Cavanaugh, a gaunt, humorless man whose scowl could peel the paint off a barn. But a lot of the local farmers went there, and I thought Helen might meet someone nice. One day, about 6 weeks after Helen had arrived, we were in the stuffy church, standing then kneeling, then sitting, then standing again as we listened to the Mass. Incense wafted up to the ceiling. Helen had been wearing baggy dresses and a loose coat to hide her condition, but suddenly she fainted dead away. Father Cavanaugh rushed down from the altar. He felt her forehead, then looked at her for a moment, and something made him touch her stomach. "She's with child," he said, and glanced at a ringless finger. "And unmarried." Father Cavanaugh told Helen she must make a full confession. When she did, instead of offering her forgiveness, he warned her that her soul was in mortal danger. Because she had committed the sin of lust, he said, the only place for her in this world was one of the church's homes for wayward women. Helen came back from the visit with Father Cavanaugh more distraught than I'd ever seen her. She had no intention of going to any home, and I wouldn't have let her. But now her secret was out, and the townspeople of Red Lake began regarding both of us differently. Women stared at the ground when they passed us on the street, and cowboys felt free to give us the eye, as if the word had gone around that we were loose women. Once when we walked by a Mexican grandmother sitting on a bench, I looked back, and she was making the sign of the cross. Early one evening, a couple of weeks after Helen made her confession, I heard a knock on the teacherage door. Superintendent McIntosh, the same man who had given me the boot for my teaching job when the war was over, was standing there. He tipped his fedora, then looked past me into the room where Helen was washing the supper plates in a tin pan. "Miss Casey, may I have a word with you in private?" he asked me. "I'll go for a walk," Helen said. She wiped her hands on her apron and made her way past Mr. McIntosh, who, making a great show of civility, tipped his hat a second time. Since I didn't want Mr. McIntosh looking at the dirty dishes as well as Helen's suitcase lying open on the floor, I led him through the connecting door into the classroom. Looking out the window and fingering the brim of his fedora, Mr. McIntosh cleared his throat nervously. Then he began what was obviously a prepared speech about Helen's condition, moral standards, school policy, impressionable school children, the need to set a good example, the reputation of the Arizona Board of Education. I started arguing that Helen had no one else to turn to and stayed well away from the students, but Mr. McIntosh said there was no room for discussion. He was getting pressure from a lot of the parents. The matter was out of his hands, and while he was sorry he had to say it, the fact was, if I wanted to keep my job, Helen had to go. Then he put on his fedora and left. I still felt stung and humiliated, and I sat down for a moment at my desk. For the second time in my life, that fish-faced pencil pusher, Mr. McIntosh, was telling me I wasn't wanted. The parents of my school kids included cattle rustlers, drunks, land speculators, bootleggers, gamblers, and former prostitutes. They didn't mind me racing horses, playing poker, or drinking contraband whiskey. But my showing some compassion to a sister who'd been taken advantage of, then abandoned by a smooth-talking scoundrel, filled them with moral indignation. It made me want to throttle them all. I walked back into the teacherage. Helen was sitting on the bed smoking a cigarette. "I didn't really go for a walk," she said. "I heard everything." I spent the night holding Helen in my arms, trying to reassure her that it was all going to work out. "We'd write Mom and Dad," I told her. "They'd understand. This sort of thing happened to young women all the time, and she could go live at the ranch until the baby was born. I'd start racing horses every weekend, and I'd save all my winnings for her and the baby. And when it was born, Buster and Dorothy could raise the child as theirs, and Helen would have money to go start a new life in some fun place like New Orleans or Kansas City. We have all sorts of options," I said, "but this one makes the most sense." Helen, however, was inconsolable. She was convinced that Mom in particular would never forgive her for bringing shame on the family. Mom and Dad would disown her, she believed. the same way our servant girl Lupe's parents had kicked her out when she got pregnant. No man would ever want her again, Helen said. She had no place to go. She wasn't as strong as me, she said, and couldn't make it on her own. Don't you ever feel like giving up? Helen asked. I just feel like giving up. That's nonsense, I said. You're much stronger than you think. There's always a way out. I talked again about the cottonwood tree. I also told her about the time I was sent home from the Sisters of Loretto because Dad wouldn't pay my tuition, and how Mother Albertina had told me that when God closes a window, he opens a door, and it was up to us to find it. Helen finally seemed to find comfort in my words. Maybe you're right, she said. Maybe there's a way. I was still awake and lying in bed with Helen when the first gray light of dawn began to appear in the window. Helen had finally fallen asleep, and I studied her face as it emerged from the shadows. That silly platinum hair had fallen forward, and I tucked it behind her ear. Her eyes were swollen from all the crying she'd been doing, but her features were still delicate, her skin still pale and smooth. And as the light filled the room, her face seemed to glow. She looked to me like an angel, a slightly bloated, pregnant angel, but an angel nonetheless. All of a sudden, I felt a lot better about things. It was Saturday. I got out of bed, put on my trousers, and brewed some strong coffee. When it was ready, I brought Helen a cup and told her it was time to rise and shine. A new day was beginning, and we had to get out in the world and make the most of it. What we'd do, I said, was borrow the flivver from Jim and go for a picnic up in the Grand Canyon. Those mighty cliffs would give us some perspective on our puny little problems. Helen smiled as she sat there drinking her coffee. I told her I'd go get the car while she got dressed, and we'd get an early start to make the most of the day. Back in a jiffy, I said at the door. Okay, Helen said. And Lily, I'm glad you asked me to come out here. It was a beautiful morning. The air so clear and crisp in the sharp light of the November sun that every twig and blade of grass stood out. The rain had turned the color of hay. There was not a wisp of cloud to be seen anywhere, and the mourning doves were cooing in the cedars. I walked past the old adobe houses and the newer frame houses, past the cafe and the gas station, past the farm families in town for market day. And then all at once, I felt like something was choking me. I put my hand to my throat, and in that instant, I was overtaken with a horrible feeling of dread. I turned back and ran as fast as I could, the stores and houses and puzzled farmers all flying by in one big blur. But when I flung open the door, I was too late. My little sister was dangling from a rafter, a kicked over chair beneath her. She'd hanged herself. Father Cavanaugh wouldn't let me bury Helen in the Catholic cemetery. Suicide was a mortal sin, he said, the worst of all sins, because it was the only one for which it was impossible to repent and receive forgiveness. Therefore, suicides were not allowed to be buried in hallowed ground. So Jim Rooster and I drove out onto the range, far from town. We found a beautiful site at the top of a rise, overlooking a shallow forested valley. So beautiful, I knew that in God's eyes, it must be sacred. And we buried Helen there, in my red silk shirt. Chapter 5. Lambs. When people kill themselves, they think they're ending the pain, but all they're doing is passing it on to those they leave behind. For months after Helen's death, pain laid so dark and heavy on me, like a big slab of lead, that most days I wouldn't have gotten out of bed if I hadn't had kids to teach. The idea of riding horses, much less racing, playing cards or driving the flivver out into the country seemed so pointless as to be repulsive. Everything got on my nerves. Kids yelling or even just laughing in the schoolyard. Church bells ringing, birds chirping. What the hell was there to chirp about? I thought of quitting my job, but I was under contract, and anyway, I couldn't blame the kids for what the parents had done. But I was through with Red Lake, and when the school year was over, I was moving on. I wasn't even sure I wanted to be a teacher anymore. I felt like I'd given everything I had to the kids of this town. And when I needed a little understanding, their families hadn't cut me any slack. Maybe I should stop devoting myself to other people's kids and instead have some kids of my own. I had never particularly wanted kids. But when Helen killed herself, she also killed a little baby inside her. And something about that made me want to bring another baby into the world. As time passed, and without my even realizing it, this idea of having a baby of my own eased my grief. One day in the spring, I got up early, as usual, and sat on the front step of the teacherage, drinking my coffee as the sun rose over the San Francisco mountains to the east. The shafts of light gliding across the plateau had that golden color that they get in the spring, and when they reached me, they warmed my face and arms. I realized that in the months since Helen had died, I hadn't been paying much attention to things like the sunrise, but that old sun had been coming up anyway. It didn't really care how I felt. It was going to rise and set, regardless of whether I noticed it. And if I was going to enjoy it, that was up to me. And if I was going to have a baby, I needed to find a husband. I started looking at Jim Smith in a different light. He had plenty of good qualities, but the most important one was I felt I could trust that man inside and out. Once I made up my mind about this, I didn't see the need to beat around the bush or make any grand gestures. It was late afternoon in early May with school over for the day when I saddled up Patches and rode over to the garage. Jim was on his back underneath a car, and all I could see were his legs and boots sticking out. I told him I needed to talk to him. So he slowly pushed himself out and stood up, wiping the grease off his hands with a rag. "Jim Smith, do you want to marry me?" I asked. He stared at me a moment, then broke into a big grin. "Lily Casey, I wanted to marry you ever since I saw you take that fall off that Mustang and then get right back on him. I've just been waiting for a good time to ask." "Well, this is it," I said. "Now, I only got two conditions." "Yes, ma'am." "The first is that we've got to be partners. Whatever we do, we'll be in it together, each sharing the load."
"Sounds good to me."
"The second is, I know you were raised a Mormon, but I don't want you taking any more wives."
"Lily Casey, from what I know of you, you're just about as much woman as any man can handle."
When I told Jim how my crumb-bum first husband had given me a fake ring, he got out a Sears Roebuck catalog, and we chose a ring together, so I'd know I was getting the genuine article. We got married in my classroom once school was out for the summer. Rooster was the best man. Before the ceremony, he gave me a kiss. "I knew I was going to smooch you one day, but I didn't think it would be because you were marrying my buddy," he said. "Still, I'll take what I can get." Rooster had a friend with an accordion, and since I still had a soft spot for teaching, instead of Mendelssohn's wedding march, I asked him to play the PTA anthem. The year was 1930, and I was 29. A lot of women my age had children who were practically grown, but getting a late start didn't mean that I wouldn't enjoy the journey every bit as much, maybe even more. Jim understood why I wanted to leave Red Lake, and he agreed to move his garage to Ash Fork, about 30 miles west, just over the Yavapai County line. Ash Fork was a bustling little town on Route 66 at the base of the Williams Mountain. It was a stop on the Santa Fe Railroad, with a roundhouse, and some days the streets were filled with sheep being shipped to market. Ash Fork had a general store run by a descendant of George Washington's brother, not one but two churches, and a Harvey House restaurant for the railroad passengers, where Harvey girls in white aprons served you an entire quarter pie when you ordered a slice, and diners wiped their mouths with elegant linen napkins. At the Ash Fork Bank, Jim and I took out a loan and built a garage made of Coconino sandstone, laying the stones and spreading the mortar ourselves. We hung the garage sign from Red Lake over the door. With the money from the loan, we sent off for a tire pump, a ball-bearing handle jack, and a stack of ribbed tread tires from the same Sears catalog that we'd used to order my ring.
We also brought the gas pump with us from Red Lake. The big glass cylinder on top was filled with gasoline, dyed red so you could tell it apart from kerosene. And every time you filled a car, air bubbles gurgled up through it. Business was brisk. Since we were partners, Jim taught me to pump gas. The pump was hand-operated. I'd pump, 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 and the gas would go glug, glug, glug. I also changed oil and fixed flat tires. By that winter, I was pregnant. But I was still pitching in every day, filling up gas tanks and making change while Jim worked on cars. We built a little house, also made of Coconino sandstone, right on Route 66, which was still a dirt road. And in the dry season, dust kicked up by the wagon wheels and automobile tires sometimes drifted through the windows, coating the furniture. But I love that house. We ordered the plumbing system from Sears and installed it ourselves. In the kitchen, we had running water that gushed out of shiny nickel-plated faucets and a chain-flush toilet, just like the rich people I cleaned for in Chicago, with a porcelain enamel bowl and a lid of mahogany veneer. When the house was finished, Rooster paid us a visit. Like my dad, he couldn't believe that anyone would want a crapper in the house. "Ain't it unsanitary?" he asked. "Everything goes down the pipe," I said. "If you want to freeze your behind off in an outhouse, that's fine by me." Rooster was just one of those people who didn't like change, regardless of how it might improve his lot. As for me, I was so damn proud of that indoor plumbing that if someone looking for directions knocked on the door, I couldn't resist the temptation to say, "Would you like a glass of fresh tap water?" Or, "Do you by chance need to use the toilet?" By the time I was 8.5 months pregnant, I had swelled up pretty big. I was happy to continue working at the garage, but Jim thought that in my condition, it might be dangerous. I could slip on an oil spill, he said, or faint from gasoline fumes, or break my water trying to twist off a rusted radiator cap. So he insisted I stay at home where I'd be safe. For a lot of women, it didn't get any better than that, lounging around in a housecoat with nothing to do. But after a few days, I started getting cabin fever, cooped up by myself reading books and mending clothes, and maybe that was why I got so irritated with the Jehovah's Witness who stopped by. I was usually friendly to folks like Jehovah's Witnesses, admiring their genuine conviction, but this fella was particularly persistent, lecturing me, giving me a lot of poppycock about how Armageddon was imminent, and for the sake of my unborn baby, I needed to seek salvation and convert. Who the hell was he to tell me what I had to believe? I asked. All folks needed to find their own way to heaven. One of the problems of the world today was all the muttonheads, like those bolshies in Russia, going around convinced they were the only ones who had the answers and killing everyone who didn't agree with them. I got so steamed up, pacing back and forth and arguing with a fellow, that without thinking about what I was doing, I sat down on my sewing, and the needle stuck me in the behind. I let out a yelp, started cussing, and tried to work the needle out of my rear, while the Jehovah's Witness wagged his finger and argued that this was a sure sign from Jesus that I needed to see the error of my way and get right with the Lord. "What it's a sign of, mister," I said, "is that I shouldn't be staying at home by myself, getting into theological arguments with harebrained strangers." I headed back to the garage where I told Jim what had happened. "I don't care if I only man the cash register," I said. "But I'm working until I go into labor. Sitting at home is just too dangerous." The baby came 2 weeks later, on a scorching hot July day. I gave birth at home with the help of Granny Combs, the best midwife in Yavapai County. One of Granny Combs's legs was shorter than the other, and she walked with an even worse limp than my dad. She also chewed tobacco, though she was a spitter and not a swallower like Rooster. Still, all the women in the county swore by her. "If Granny Combs couldn't bring your baby into this world," they said, "it wasn't meant to be here." When I went into labor, the pain started coming in waves. Granny Combs told me that I couldn't stop the pain, but she could teach me how to get the best of it. What I needed to do was separate the actual pain from the fear that something terrible was happening to my body. "The pain is your body complaining," she said. If you listen to the pain and tell your body, yeah, I hear you, then you won't be so afraid of it. I'm not saying the pain goes away, but it ain't gonna make you crazy either. My labor lasted only a couple of hours, and Granny Combs' advice did keep the pain in check, sort of. When the baby came out, Granny Combs said, "It's a girl," and held her up. She was purple, and I felt a stab of alarm. But Granny Combs started slapping and kneading her, and the baby let out a cry and gradually turned pink. Granny Combs cut the cord and rubbed the baby's navel with a burned cork to close up the wound. Granny Combs had a sixth sense, the way I sometimes felt I did, and could read minds and tell fortunes. While I held the baby and nursed her, Granny Combs tore herself a plug of tobacco and laid out cards to see what the future had in store for my newborn. "She will have a long life, and it will be eventful," Granny Combs said. "Will she be happy?" I asked. Granny Combs chewed her tobacco and studied the cards. "I see a wanderer." I named the baby Rosemary. Roses were my favorite flower. Mary was a good Catholic girl's name, and Rosemary was a darned useful herb. I was hoping the kid would have a practical side. Most babies looked to me like monkeys or Buddhas, but Rosemary was a beautiful thing. When her hair came in, it was so pale and fine it looked white. By the time she was 3 months old, she had a wide smile to match her merry green eyes. And even early on, it seemed to me she looked a lot like Helen. Helen's beauty, as far as I was concerned, had been a curse, and I resolved that I would never tell Rosemary she was beautiful. A boy followed a year and a half later. A big new hospital had just opened in the town of Williams, 40 miles to the east, and I was determined to have my baby there. But as I went into labor, a hellacious winter storm blew in from Canada, covering the roads with drifting snow. We almost didn't make it through, the flivver spinning and skidding, but Jim got out the jack and put the chains on the wheels, hunkering down against the driving snow, while I sat there taking deep breaths behind the steamed-up windows. We arrived just as my contractions were becoming severe. Granny Combs's mind-over-matter method of getting through pain was pretty good when it came to a stubbed toe, and it had helped me get through my first childbirth, but it couldn't compare with the marvelous modern anesthesia they used to knock me out at the hospital this time. The doctor put that mask over my face, and I just drifted off to dreamland. When I woke up, I had a son. He was a big bruiser of a boy, the first baby born in that hospital, and the nurses and doctors were as proud as Jim and me. We named him after his dad, and from the outset called him Little Jim. It was around then that hard times hit northern Arizona. A big part of the problem was that too many farmers and greenhorn ranchers had moved into the area. They didn't understand that Arizona wasn't like the land back east, where thousands of years of decaying trees had built up a deep loam. This land had just a thin layer of topsoil that, if plowed, would blow away with the first strong wind. The greenhorns had all made fun of the Navajos for planting each stalk of corn in a little hole 3 feet from the next, instead of a foot apart in plowed rows. But the Indians understood that was all the soil could bear. Land that God had never intended for the till had been farmed beyond its limit, and too many cattle had grazed the once green range into hard, dry stubble. The grass couldn't reseed, and when it rained, there wasn't enough grass to hold the water, so it would run off, eroding the good soil, and the fine land would be ruined forever. When a long drought hit, stretches of countryside all around the state turned to swirling dust, which rose half a mile into the air. At the same time, the country was a few years into the Depression. At first, that seemed like a problem afflicting mostly the big cities, but it soon hurt the cattle market because so many folks back east couldn't afford to eat steak anymore. Some of the littler ranchers in Arizona started going under, and ranch hands joined the stream of Okies making their way past our house on Route 66 in hopes of finding work in California. A lot of people could no longer afford gas, and they began selling off the tractors and cars they'd been persuaded to buy, leaving many of them wishing they'd kept their plow horses. Business at the garage dwindled. Jim was also too generous for his own good. undercharging people who were poor and even doing repairs for free. I sat at the kitchen table with a pencil and paper, working the numbers, looking for ways to cut expenses, but no matter what angle I came at it from, the bottom line was inescapable. We had more going out than coming in, and it was just a matter of time before we went broke. With the loans we'd taken out, that meant bankruptcy. I took the babies to the garage and helped out as much as I could, but I figured there must be something else we could do to bring in a little extra cash. One day, Mr. Lee, the Ashwork Chinaman, knocked on our door. Mr. Lee ran a chop suey joint in a tent near the garage and made enough money from it to drive a Model A that Jim repaired. Mr. Lee was usually one happy, beaming Chinaman, but that day he was in a panic. Prohibition had ended a few years earlier, but a lot of people had gotten used to the easy money that came from selling bootleg liquor. And Mr. Lee was one of them, offering his customers shots of homebrew to wash down their noodles. But it heard the revenuers were onto him, and he was looking for a place to hide a few cases of booze. Mr. Lee and Jim had hit it off because Mr. Lee had been a soldier in Manchuria when Jim was seeing service in Siberia, and they'd lived through the same bitter winters, picking icicles out of their hair and gnawing on frozen meat. Mr. Lee trusted Jim. We agreed to take the booze and stash the cases under little Jim's crib, where they were hidden by the skirt. That night, I lay awake thinking about Mr. Lee's hooch, and a plan occurred to me. I could bring in extra money by selling bootleg booze out the back door. Although Dad had been a staunch prohibitionist, his pa had sold booze from the store on the KC Ranch, so I had family tradition going for me. Also, I never saw anything wrong with an honest man taking a well-deserved drink. I even had one myself from time to time. When I proposed the idea to Jim at breakfast the next morning, he wasn't so keen on it. Although he had stopped drinking years ago, after shooting up some Canadian town while on a bender, he didn't have a problem with booze itself. He just didn't want to see the mother of his two children wind up in jail for rum running. It was because I was a mother with two kids, I said, as well as a respected former school teacher, that the revenuers would never suspect me. There was a definite market out there, since everyone was looking to save pennies wherever they could. It wasn't like we'd be running a speakeasy, just a little retail operation with absolutely no overhead. And would even be striking a blow for the little guy, giving a hard-working cowboy a chance to have a drink without being forced to fork over a nickel to Uncle Sam every time he did so. I kept hammering away at Jim, pointing out that I couldn't see any other way to keep us afloat. And because I would give him no peace on the matter, he reluctantly agreed. Since we'd done him a favor, Mr. Lee also agreed, promising to provide me 2 cases a month from his bootlegger if we split the profit. I was a good liquor lady. I discreetly put the word out, and soon local cowboys were knocking at the back door. I sold only to people I knew, or to those who came recommended. I kept things friendly but businesslike, inviting them in briefly, but not allowing anyone to linger around or drink on the premises. I began to get regular customers, including the Catholic priest, who always blessed the babies on the way out. My regulars got a discount, but I never gave credit, and I never sold to anyone I thought was drinking the rent money. After Mr. Lee got his cut, I made a quarter on each bottle I sold. Soon I was averaging 3 bottles a day, and that extra $20 or so a month balanced the books. One day that spring, when Rosemary was 3 and little Jim was starting to talk, the Camel brothers drove their huge flock of sheep past our house and into town toward the depot. The Camel brothers had bought a big ranch west of Ash Fork in Yavapai County with the idea of raising sheep for wool and mutton. They were from Scotland and knew a lot about sheep, but precious little about conditions on the Arizona range. The Camel brothers had decided that the forage in Yavapai County was too dry for sheep, especially with the drought, and they'd made up their minds to sell off their flock, as well as the ranch, rather than watch their sheep grow gaunt and weak while more and more of them got picked off by wolves and hungry hobos. It was a dry, hot day, and the sheep filled the streets of Ash Fork, kicking up the dust so bad you had to cover your mouth with a bandana. The ewes were bleeding, and the lambs were mewing as the Camel brothers' hands rode back and forth, driving the flock toward the shipping station cracking whips at the wandering strays. The Campbell brothers weren't there. They were back at the ranch, rounding up the remaining sheep. And when the flock reached the shipping pen, some numbskull hand got the brilliant idea of separating the lambs from their mothers. As soon as they'd accomplished that, bedlam broke loose. The lambs were still nursing and were hungry from the journey, so they started scrambling around, crying for their mothers. The ewes, for their part, were frantically calling out for their babies. The hands, realizing their mistake, opened the gate separating the ewes from the lambs, and the sheep all mingled together, mothers looking for babies and babies looking for mothers. That was when things got really bad. The more frantic the lambs became, the more energy they burned, which made them all the hungrier. But the flock was so big and so jumbled up that none of them could find their mothers. After a couple of hours of this, the lambs grew weak from hunger. They tried to nurse from any ewe they could, but the ewes wanted to save the milk for their own babies. They put their noses up to the lambs, and if the smell was unfamiliar, the ewes kicked them away and continued searching for their own. The hands, frantic themselves, were waiting around in the flock, trying to force the ewes to let any lamb nurse. But the ewes weren't cooperating. They were kicking and bawling and squirming, making a god-awful racket, and filling the air with even more dust as the cowboys cursed, and the townspeople who'd gathered around stood there watching, some calling out advice, others chuckling, shaking their heads, and waiting to see how it was all going to play out. I was there with little Jim and Rosemary, who was fascinated by the idea that a ewe could smell its own lamb and was running around shoving her nose into the lamb's wool. "They all just smell like sheep to me," she announced. The Campbell brothers finally showed up, but they were at a loss about what to do, and the situation was getting desperate, with lambs starting to drop from heat and hunger. "You should talk to my husband," I said. "He knows animals." The Campbell brothers sent for Jim, who was at the garage. When he arrived, the hands explained what had happened. "What we got to do," Jim said, "is to get those ewes to accept any lamb as her own for the time being. Then we can worry about straightening out the flock." Jim sent me back to the house for an old bedsheet while he fetched 2 cans of kerosene from the garage. He had the camel hands tear the sheet into rags, dip the rags in the kerosene, and wipe the ewes' noses with them. That blocked their sense of smell, and they let whatever lamb was at hand nurse their milk. Once the lambs had been fed and the immediate crisis had passed, Jim had the hands separate the lambs and the ewes again. One by one, they brought each lamb into the ewe pen and carried it around until its mother recognized it. The flock was so big that this took the better part of 2 days, with stops to douse the mother's noses again whenever the remaining lambs got hungry. Little Rosemary was riveted by the scene and terribly concerned that all the lambs find their mothers, and she stayed there watching the entire time. When it was finally done, there was one little lamb that no ewe had claimed. Its black eyes were frightened, its white wool thick with dust, and it ran around on its spindly legs, bleeding mournfully. The Campbell brothers told Jim to do whatever he thought best with the lamb. Jim scooped it up in his arms and carried it over to Rosemary. He knelt down and set the lamb in front of her. "All animals are meant for something," he said. "Some to run wild, some for the barnyard, some for the market. This little lamb was meant to be a pet." Rosemary loved that creature. She shared her ice cream cones with it, and it followed her everywhere. So we decided to name it Mai Mai, which Mr. Lee told us was Chinese for little sister. A couple of weeks after Jim straightened out the flock, I heard the sound of a car pulling around the house, and then a knock on the back door. A man was standing outside, smoking a cigarette. He'd left his car door open, and a girl and a young woman were sitting inside, watching us. He was a good-looking fellow, with a lock of sandy hair falling across his forehead, and although his teeth were crooked and stained, he had the easy smile of a charmer. Even before he said anything, I could tell from the slightly off-balance way he was standing that he was a little potted. "I'm a friend of Rooster's," he said, "and I heard this is where a man could get his hands on a good bottle of shellac." "Looks to me like you're already pretty shellacked," I said. "Well, I'm working on it," His smile became even more charming. But I looked over at the woman and the girl, and they weren't smiling at all. "I think you've had enough to drink as it is," I said. His smile disappeared, and he got all indignant, the way drunks do when you point out that they're drunk. He started telling me his money was as good as anyone else's, and who was I to go around deciding who had and who hadn't had too much to drink. I was just some two-bit moonshine madam. But I didn't budge. And when he realized I wasn't giving in and he'd be leaving empty-handed, he really lost it, telling me I was going to regret crossing him and calling me nothing but the sister of a whore who hanged herself. "Wait right there," I said. Leaving the door open, I walked into the bedroom, got my pearl-handled revolver, walked back out, and pointed it at the man's face. The end of the barrel was about 6 inches from his nose. "The only reason I don't shoot you right now is because of those two women in that car," I said. "But you get out of here and don't ever come back." That night I told Jim what had happened. He sighed and shook his head. "We probably haven't seen the end of it," he said. Sure enough, 2 days later, a car pulled around the house, and when I opened the door, two men in khaki uniforms and cowboy hats were standing there. They had badges on their shirt pockets, guns in their holsters, and handcuffs dangling from their belts. They tipped their hats. "Afternoon, ma'am," one of them said. He hitched up his pants and stuck his thumbs in his belt. "Mind if we come in?" I didn't see that I had much choice in the matter, so I led them into the living room. Little Jim was asleep in the crib, and under it, behind the white cotton skirt, were two cases of bootleg hooch. "Would you fellows like a nice cool glass of tap water?" I asked. "Thank you, ma'am, no," the talker said. They were both glancing around, trying to suss the place out. "We received a report," he went on, "that liquor is being illegally sold from these premises." At that moment, Rosemary came running into the room with Mai-Mai right behind. It must have been the sight of all that gleaming metal and shiny leather, but as soon as Rosemary saw the two lawmen, she gave out a shriek that could have woken the dead. Howling, she flung herself at my feet and grabbed my ankles. I tried to pick her up, but she'd become truly hysterical and was flailing her arms, screaming and blubbering. Mai-Mai was bleeding, and all the noise woke little Jim, who stood up in the crib and started wailing. "Does this look like a speakeasy?" I asked. "I'm a school teacher. I'm a mother. I got my hands full here just taking care of these kids." "I can see that," he said. All the screaming was discombobulating the two of them. "We have to check these things out, but we'll be on our way." The lawmen were happy to be out of there, and as soon as they left, Rosemary stopped her howling. "You sure saved my chestnuts, little girl," I said. When Jim came home, I told him about the visit from the law and how the chorus of howling youngsters had driven those deputies right out the door. It already seemed to me like a pretty funny story, and it got Jim laughing too. But then he stopped and said, "Even so, they were putting us on warning. It's time we get out of the bootleg business." "But Jim," I said, "we need the money. I'd rather see you in the poorhouse than behind bars." Selling liquor had kept us afloat for a year, but we shut the operation down, and 6 months later, the bank foreclosed on us. Fall was usually my favorite time of the year, when the air turned cool and the hills were green from the August rains. But I didn't have much time to enjoy the September sunsets and the crisp, starry nights. Jim and I had decided to auction off everything. The furniture, his tools, the tire pump, the handle jack, and the gas pump with its pretty glass cylinder. Once we'd done that, we would strap our suitcases on the roof of the Flivver and join the stream of Okies heading to California for work. Mulling our prospects made us both feel ground down and wound up. One morning, we were in the garage, tagging tools and arguing about what we should take with us, when Blackie Camel, the older of the two Camel brothers, stopped by. Blackie was a swag-bellied man with a bushy black beard who wore his embroidered vest everywhere. He was kind of a mathematical genius when it came to sheep, and he could glance at a flock and tell you not only how many animals were in it, but how many pounds of wool they were carrying. Ever since Jim had saved the lambs, Blackie had taken to dropping by the garage to shoot the breeze. The more he got to know Jim, the more he liked him. Jim, he was fond of telling people, not only knew sheep, he knew cattle and horses and just about every creature with fur or feathers. Jim never bragged about himself, which Blackie also liked, and Blackie was particularly impressed with a story he'd heard from a local Hopi about how when Jim was a young man, an eagle was going after a newborn calf, and Jim actually lassoed the bird in midair. That morning, as we sat at the wobbly linoleum table Jim used as his desk, Blackie told us that he and his brother had sold their ranch to a group of investors in England who wanted to run cattle there. They had asked him and his brother to recommend someone to manage the ranch, and Blackie said that if Jim was so inclined, he and his brother would put Jim's name forward. Jim reached under the table and squeezed my hand so hard that my knuckles cracked. We both knew the only jobs out in California were picking grapes and oranges, and the Okies were fighting over what little work existed, while the Daddy Warbucks owners kept cutting everyone's wages. But there was no way we were going to acknowledge to Blackie Camel how desperate we were. "Sounds like something worth considering," Jim said. Blackie sent a telegram to London, and a few days later, he dropped by to tell Jim the job was his. We called off the auction, and Jim kept most of his tools, but we did sell the gasoline pump and tires to a mechanic from Sedona. Rooster brought a buckboard down from Red Lake, and we loaded our furniture onto it, put the kids and Mai Mai in the back of the flivver, and then, with Jim behind the wheel, Rooster on the wagon, and me bringing up the rear on patches, we set out on our little procession for Seligman, the town nearest the ranch. That part of the journey was smooth and passed quickly because Route 66 was being paved for the first time with a layer of shiny black asphalt. Seligman wasn't as big as Ash Fork, but it had everything a ranch town needed. A building that served as both the jail and post office, a hotel, a bar and a cafe, and the commercial central, a general store where pairs of Levi's were stacked 4 feet high on the wide planked floors next to the shovels, spools of rope and wire, water buckets, and tins of crackers. From Seligman, we headed west for 15 miles, through rolling rangeland covered with rabbit weed, prairie grass, and juniper trees. The Peacock Mountains in the distance were dark green, and overhead the sky was iris blue. After 15 miles, we turned off Route 66 and followed a narrow dirt road for another 9 miles. It took a full day to get from Seligman to the ranch by wagon. Finally, late in the afternoon, we came to a gate where the road just ended. To the right and the left of the gate, barbed wire fencing, held up by neatly trimmed juniper saplings, stretched away into the distance. There was no sign on the gate, which was closed, but we were expected, so the gate was dummy locked. The chain that kept it shut was held together by a padlock that had been left unsnapped. Beyond the gate was a long driveway. We followed it another 4 miles and finally reached a fenced-in compound with a collection of unpainted wood buildings shaded by enormous cedar trees. The buildings were at the foot of a hill dotted with pinyon and scrub cedar. Facing east, you looked out over miles and miles of rolling rangeland that gradually sloped down toward a flat grassy basin known as the Colorado Plateau. It stretched out all the way to the Moleon Rim, big blush-colored bluffs where the earth had shifted along a single fault line that ran all the way to New Mexico. From where we stood, you could see forever, and there wasn't a single other house, human being, or the slightest sign of civilization. Only the huge sky, the endless grassy plain, and the distant mountains. The Camel brothers had let most of the hired help go, and the place was deserted except for one remaining hand, old Jake, a grizzled, stogie-chewing coot who came limping out of the barn to greet us. Old Jake had a lopsided walk because, to avoid serving in the Great War, he had put his foot on a railroad track and let a train run over his toes. "Won't win any dancing contests," he said, "but don't need toes to ride, and it beats spitting up mustard gas." Old Jake showed us around. There was a main house with a long porch, its unpainted wood siding a sun-bleached gray. The barn was huge, and next to it were 4 small log buildings, the granary and the smithy, the meat house where hides and sides of beef were cured, and the poison house, which had shelves full of bottles containing medicines, potions, spirits, and solvents, all with corks or rags stuffed in their tops. Old Jake kept pointing out various details. The bags of sulfur and jars of tar used for treating injured livestock. The knife sharpener in the smithy. The troughs that collected runoff rainwater from the roofs. He took us into the other outbuildings, including a tool shed, chicken coop, and bunkhouse. Then we came to a garage filled with 26 carriages, wagons, and vehicles. Brogans, Surreys, Phaetons, an old Conestoga-covered wagon, a few beat-up cars, a rusty Chevy pickup. Old Jake proudly named every one. He showed us the pit in the garage that you could climb down into, then have someone dry the car over it when you needed to work on the undercarriage. Finally, Old Jake led us back through the barn to a double corral, one made of 6-foot-high saplings posted vertically and used to break horses, the other made of standard post and wire fencing, with a small herd of tough little ponies inside it. Jim walked around, nodding and taking it all in. We could both see that although the buildings were weathered, they were solid and true. There was nothing fancy about the place. It was a real working ranch. But tools were hung in their place, ropes coiled neatly, harnesses mended, fence posts stacked in tidy bundles, and the barn floor was swept. On a ranch, you had to be able to find a given tool in a hurry when there was an emergency, and you had to hand it to the Camel brothers. They knew the importance of keeping things ship-shape. Rooster was visibly impressed. "A fella could do a lot worse than this," he said. "Jim, you old hound dog, you got lucky." He glanced at me. "Again," he added. I swatted Rooster on the arm, but Jim just shook his head and grinned. Then he looked out across the range. "I think we can make this work," he said. "I think we can," I said. I could tell life at the ranch was going to be a lot of hard work. We were too far from town to count on anyone else for anything. Jim and I would have to be our own veterinarian, farrier, mechanic, butcher, cook, as well as cattle driver, ranch manager, husband and wife, and mother and father of 2 little children. But Jim and I both knew how to roll up our sleeves, and in times like these, I knew how lucky we were not just to have work, but to be our own bosses, doing something we were good at doing. I felt nature calling and asked Old Jake where I could find the facilities. He pointed toward a little wooden shed in the north corner of the compound. "It's nothing fancy, just a one-holer," he said. "No moon cutting the door to advertise it either, 'cause we all know what it is." Inside the outhouse, once you'd closed the door that didn't have a moon, enough light came through the cracks in the wood so that you could see. Spiderwebs dangled in the roof corners, a sack of lime set on the dirt floor, and there was a scoop to sprinkle it into the hole to keep the flies down. A distinctly malodorous aroma arose from the hole, and for a moment, I missed my snazzy mail-order toilet with the shiny white porcelain bowl, the mahogany lid, and the nifty pool chain flush. As I sat down, though, I realized that you can get so used to certain luxuries that you start to think they're necessities. But when you have to forego them, you come to see that you don't need them at all. There was a big difference between needing things and wanting things, though a lot of people had trouble telling the two apart. And at the ranch, I could see, we'd have pretty much everything we'd need, but precious little else. Next to the seat was a stack of Sears Roebuck catalogs, and I picked up one and leafed through it. I came to a page advertising silk bodices and lacy chemises. "I won't be ordering from this page," I thought. And when I was done with my business, that was the one I tore out and used. The following morning, as Rooster was getting ready to head back to Red Lake, he caught me alone in the kitchen. "Thank you for helping us move," I said, and handed him a cup of coffee. He looked at me for a moment. "You know, I always been carrying a torch for you," he said. "I know." "Funny," he said. "Just can't help it." He paused and then asked, "You think I'll ever get married?" "I do," I said. I had just been being polite, but suddenly I saw it clearly. The right woman was out there for him. "I do," I said again. "You just got to look in unexpected places." After Rooster left, Jim said our first order of business was to tour the ranch. It was a big place, with a little over 100,000 acres, almost 160 square miles, and it would take us at least a week just to ride the outer fence line. We loaded one pony with supplies. Jim and old Jake mounted up two others, and I was on patches with little Jim in my lap, while Rosemary climbed on with her dad. We headed west until we reached white and yellow limestone foothills, then swung south. A hot, dry wind blew across the valley. We passed pinyon and juniper trees, and now and then saw a herd of white-tailed antelope on distant slopes grazing on the gamma grass. Old Jake showed us Tres Cruces, a group of rocks in which someone had carved stick figures of horses and riders carrying three crosses to depict, according to ranch lore, an early Spanish expedition. Late in the afternoon, we reached a high point below the Coyote Mountains. From there, we could see south toward the Juniper Mountains and east to the Mullion Rim. "Lot of land," Jim said. "Not a lick of water."
"Drier than a crone's dugs," old Jake said.
There were a few dirt ponds, small sad things dug out to collect rain, but the water disappeared during dry spells, and the ponds were now empty, cracked pits. After 10 days, we'd made a big circle, covering most of the ranch, although there were large stretches of territory we didn't have time to see. And while we passed any number of galleys and draws that you could tell ran with water during flash floods, there wasn't a single stream, spring, or natural source of water on the whole spread.
"No wonder the Camel brothers threw in the towel," Jim said.
Jim sent to Flagstaff for a water witch, and the two of them set out on another tour of the ranch, stopping at clumps of trees and spots where the grass was green. The water witch walked around, holding a forked branch in his outstretched arms, waiting for the branch to dip, a sign that there was water underground. But the branch never dipped. I kept thinking about all those gullies and draws we passed during our trip around the ranch. The only water this land would ever see was going to come from the sky. During flash floods, thousands and thousands of gallons of water would roar through all those gullies and draws only to soak through the range floor. If we could figure out how to trap that water for ourselves, we'd have plenty. "What we really need to do is build a dam," I told Jim.
"How?" he said. "You'd need an army."
I thought about it for a while, and then it came to me. I'd read magazine articles about the building of the Boulder Dam, as it was called by those of us who hated Herbert Hoover and refused to call it the Hoover Dam. Alongside the articles were photographs of some of the newfangled earth-moving machines used in the construction. "Jim," I said, "let's rent us a bulldozer." At first, Jim thought I was nuts, but I decided we at least needed to look into the idea. I drove into Seligman, and someone knew someone in Phoenix who had a construction company with a bulldozer. Sure enough, when I tracked him down, he said that if we were willing to pay for it, he could send his bulldozer and its operator up to Seligman by rail. We'd need to find a flatbed truck to haul it out to the ranch. It wouldn't be cheap, but once the bulldozer was here, it could build a good-sized earth dam in a matter of days. Jim said we needed to present the idea to the English investors. A group of them was headed our way in a few weeks to meet us and survey the property. The Palms arrived by wagon after taking a steamer from England to New York and a train to Flagstaff. A 3-week trip. They had clipped accents and wore bowler hats and suits with vests. None of them had ever pulled on a pair of cowboy boots or cracked a bullwhip, but that was just fine with Jim and me. They were businessmen, not dudes out to play cowboy. And they were polite and smart. You could tell from the questions they asked that they knew what they didn't know. The first night they arrived, old Jake built a fire and roasted a shoulder of beef. He kept making fun of the investors under his breath, saying things like, "rather cheeky," and "jolly good," in an English accent, and rolling up his cowboy hat to look like a bowler, so I had to bop him in the back of the head. I prepared a few range specialties, like rattlesnake stew and prairie oysters, to give them something to talk about when they got back to their London clubs. Afterward, we sat around the fire eating tins of sliced peaches. Jim took out his little cotton sack of Bull Durham, rolled himself a cigarette, closing the sack by pulling on the yellow string with his teeth like he always did, then made his pitch. "Only two things really mattered to a rancher," he said, "land and water. We had plenty of land in these parts, but not enough water. And without water, the land ain't worth nothing. Water made the difference.
Water out here is precious, he said. More precious than you gentlemen, living on that rainy island of yours, can possibly imagine. That was why, for centuries, the Indians and the Mexicans and the Anglos had all been fighting over it. Why families were torn apart over it. Why neighbors killed each other over it. One of the palms piped up to say he knew firsthand how precious water was, because at the hotel in Seligman, he'd been charged an extra 50 cents to take a bath. Everyone got a laugh out of that, and it made me hope that Jim's pitch would receive a sympathetic hearing. Seeing as how the ranch had no natural source of water, Jim said, one had to be created if it was going to support a sizable herd. Some ranches went drilling for water, but you might drill all sorts of dry holes before you actually found water, and there was no guarantee of how long it would last. When the Santa Fe Railroad had needed water for its steam engines, it had drilled a hole half a mile deep in these parts and come up dry. What made the most sense, Jim went on, was to build a big dam and trap rainwater. He described my plan to bring a bulldozer from Phoenix. When Jim mentioned the cost, the palms looked at one another, and a few raised their eyebrows. But then Jim pulled out a column of numbers I'd drawn up and explained that without the dam, you could run only a few thousand head on the ranch. With it, they could go to 20,000, and that meant bringing 5,000 head to market every year. The dam would pay for itself in no time. The next day, the Palms went into Seligman to cable the rest of the investors. After some backing and forthing about engineering details, we got the go-ahead. The Palms wrote a check before they left, and in no time, a flatbed truck was pulling up to the ranch with a big yellow bulldozer on the back. It was the first bulldozer to be seen in these parts, and people came from all over Yavapai County to marvel at it chugging away. Since we had the darn contraption there, we decided to build dams all over the ranch. The operator scraping out the sides of gullies and draws, lining the bottoms with packed down clay, and using the fill to build up the walls that would hold back the water from the flash floods. By far the biggest dam we built, so big you needed 5 minutes to walk around it, was the one in front of the ranch house. When the rains came that December, the water coursed through the gullies and draws and poured right into the ponds created by the dams. It was just like filling a bathtub. The winter was unusually wet, and by the spring, the water was 3 feet deep in the big pond, the finest body of water I'd seen since Lake Michigan. In one sense, that pond was nothing more than a hole in the ground, but Jim treated it like our proudest possession, and that was what it was. He checked the dam every day, measuring the depth of the water and inspecting the walls. In the summer, folks drove from miles away to ask if they might take a dip, and we always let them. Sometimes during dry spells, neighbors without as much water would comb over with wagon loads of barrels and ask, as they'd put it, to borrow from our pond, though there was no way they were ever going to repay us, and we never charged for it since, as Jim liked to say, the heavens had given it to us. The dam and its pond came to be known as Big Jim's Dam and then just Big Jim. People around the county measured the severity of dry spells by the amount of water in Big Jim. How's Big Jim doing? People in town might ask me, or I hear Big Jim's low. And I always knew they were talking about the water level in the pond, not my husband's state of mind. The ranch's official name was the Arizona Incorporated Cattle Ranch, but we always called it the AIC, or just the ranch. It was only dudes and greenhorns, people who got their ideas about ranching from Western movies and dime store novels, who gussied up their ranches with highfalutin names like Acres of Eden or Rancho Mirage or Paradise Plateau. A fancy name, Jim liked to say, was a sure sign that the owner didn't know the first thing about ranching. With the Depression still going strong, owners like that, as well as plenty of owners who did know a thing or two about ranching, were going out of business. That meant more people were selling than buying cattle, and Jim traveled around Arizona picking up entire herds for rock-bottom prices.